From our studio in San Francisco's The Civic Kitchen, this is Salt and Spine.
We spoke to certain people and tried to understand what makes their life easy in the kitchen. And often it's not so much about the recipe, it's about a state of mind.
You're listening to Salt and Spine, Stories Behind Cookbooks. I'm Brian Hogan Stewart. Now, you just heard from renowned cookbook author Yotam Ottolenghi. Yotam is an Israeli-born British chef who has been credited with, among other successes, making the world love vegetables. Or so says Bon Appetit magazine, which also described watching Yotam and his collaborator, Sammy Tamini, cook as being like watching the Rolling Stones in concert. Now, if you've browsed a cookbook store in the past few years, chances are you've seen or picked up or bought one of Yotam's cookbooks, from his first self-titled book to the uber-popular and vegetable-forward duo Plenty and Plenty More. There's also Jerusalem, a cookbook, which brings us to Yotam and Sami's home city, or Nopi, featuring recipes from his London restaurant, and Sweet, which is loaded with desserts and baked goods built on his signature flavors. Which brings us to his latest and seventh cookbook, Ottolenghi Simple. Now, if you know Ottolenghi's work, simple might not be your first descriptor. We'll talk with him about that. But each of these recipes is simple in at least one way, and usually more, whether that's under 30 minutes, using just a single pot, or using ingredients just from your pantry. This is the Ottolenghi for your weeknights. In today's episode, we'll talk with Yotam about his approach to cookbooks, how his recipes and style have shaped modern home cooking, and why he never uses a food stylist. Plus, we have a special featured excerpt from the podcast Yotam recorded to coincide with his latest cookbook. Don't miss that, as we hear Yotam and Salt and Spine friend Nigella Lawson cooking together. And as always, we're stopping by Omnivore Books in San Francisco to chat with Celia Sack about Yotam Ottolenghi's unquestionable influence. All of that this week on the Ottolenghi Simple edition of Salt and Spine. Let's head now to our studio at San Francisco's The Civic Kitchen, where we sat down with Yotam Ottolenghi to talk cookbooks. Hi, Yotam. Thank you so much for joining us on Salt and Spine.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're glad to have you. So we're here to talk about your latest cookbook, which is your seventh, Ottolenghi Simple.
I know. I can't believe it's seven books already.
Yes. Exciting. Seven books. And this one is, I think, based on its title, perhaps the simplest, you could say, of all of your books.
Yes. That's pretty much it. Yeah.
Now, let's go back a little bit before we talk about this book specifically to how you sort of came to food and how you came to the cookbook industry, how you came to be working as a chef. You originally, sort of in your post-college time, were studying philosophy, comparative literature, sort of going down this path. And then something clicked for you. I think you've said you started to cook through Julia Child's cookbooks. You started to really immerse yourself in food. When did that happen for you? And what was that sort of evolution like?
It started off, so I went to university and I studied in the 1990s and I studied comparative literature and philosophy, and I had a good time, but I wasn't satisfied. I felt that there was a lot of work done and very little coming back. And I've only recently found out that what I was looking for was immediate gratification that I didn't get in that world of, you know, university and studying and all the rest.
Sure.
And I sat long hours in front of a computer screen, and I just thought, like, I want to try something else. And I never thought of it as a career option, but I always loved cooking. And I've been, since I became a student, I just used to cook for friends who came over, and it was the act of feeding and the act of shopping for ingredients. Both those things I really enjoyed doing, as well as the cooking. So I took a year off. I went to the Cordon Bleu cookery school in London, and I said, oh, well, let me see how that works out, if that works out for me. And it did. I mean, it wasn't so easy all the time, and working in a restaurant was very challenging at different stages, but I always felt that going back to immediate gratification, you know, the happy faces that you see on people's, you know, on people after they've eaten food that they loved is priceless, you know,
right.
It just doesn't compare to a to a university paper that hardly anyone reads and hardly anyone smiles over. You know, it's just not the same thing.
Sure. Yeah. And you grew up in a pretty food focused family, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My parents are both really good cooks and also adventurous cooks.
Okay.
I grew up in Israel, but they're from European descent. My dad is Italian. My mom's German. So we had kind of a great European food, you know, especially on the Italian side. My dad would always cook with a lot of fresh, good fresh ingredients and lots of olive oil. And we had polentas and pastas and, you know, everybody knows them, but they're just so good. but I also had a lot of really great Middle Eastern food, not so much at home, but because I grew up in Jerusalem, obviously with the Palestinian community and various Jewish communities, there was always a lot of that kind of Middle Eastern sensibilities, you know, the lots of garlic and lemon and chickpeas and tahini and tons of herbs and lots. So that kind of intensity of Middle Eastern cooking that people would probably know by now, I grew up with that as well. So I kind of had a little bit of everything, which was really quite a remarkable way to start your life as a eater and a cooker.
And did that influence you then in how you approach cooking and recipes today? I think you have a reputation for sort of not following particular cuisines or regionality and sort of really just focusing on ingredients and how they connect. Did that upbringing and sort of having those worlds of flavors merging together in your childhood impact how you approach recipes today?
Definitely. I don't feel bound to one culinary tradition, and it's, you know, I've been operating as, you know, as a cook, as a chef for 20 years or so. And even early on, before it became more popular to mix and match, you know, I always felt quite comfortable and feel quite comfortable mixing and shaking things up a little bit. I don't do it willy-nilly and I don't do it just for the sake of it, but I do it when I think it's fine. It's the right thing to do or so, you know, we're here in the mission, and I just went and had a couple of tacos.
Oh,
you know,
great.
It's like, and which I don't normally eat because we don't have so much in London.
Sure.
And immediately it just resonates in so many ways with Middle Eastern food, you know, the heat, the flatbread, the cooking meat and then chopping it up. I mean, which is the equivalent of a shawarma. And
so
I just feel that setting up like borderlines between cuisines is quite artificial. And there's a lot of echoes of foods that kind of reverberate between cuisines and cultures. So making those mixes is actually makes sense in many cases, not always, but in many cases it does.
Yeah. Now, your latest book is Simple, Otolenghi Simple. You acknowledge in the beginning of the book that it might feel like a contradiction to some people who pick
that.
Up this book, right? And you even note that one person's definition of simple might be different than your definition of simple or some other people who've worked on the book's definition of simple. What does simple mean to you?
Well, that's exactly it. So you kind of summed it up in a few words, in the sense that what my definition is simple in this particular case doesn't matter so much, because I mean, what is simple for me is not necessarily simple for another reader or another cook. So with this particular book, what myself and my co-authors, Tara and Esme, tried to do is really try to figure out what does simple cooking mean for different people. So before we just went and published a whole book full of easy recipes, we spoke to certain people and tried to understand what makes their life easy in the kitchen. And often it's not so much about the recipe, it's about a state of mind. And then we came up with the recipes in the book, but we also decided to curate the book in such a way that there would be a whole range of recipes for different people and their perception of easy or simple.
Right.
And I'll explain that a little bit. So some people would be inclined to say that for them, simple cooking is quick cooking.
Sure.
So, I want to finish a dish in half an hour.
Right.
Others would say, for me, it's not so much about how long it takes me. It's just about not being stressed when people come over for dinner. So I want to prepare everything in advance. I'm willing to spend an hour or two in the kitchen, but I want to get it all done the day before or in the morning and be ready for the evening.
Right.
So those are two examples of different ways of perceiving simple. So we took the word simple and we use it, the letters as an acronym for different ways of cooking simply.
Yeah.
So recipes that would have S above them will be short on time. I is for ingredients, 10 or less. M would be make ahead. P is pantry ingredient recipes that you cook from what you happen to have in your house, mostly rice, pasta, frozen peas, etc.
Sure.
L is stands for lazy recipes that are actually you just put in the oven or on your stovetop and you forget about it and then they cook yourself. And E stands for easier than you think. And those are recipes that sound complicated to some people, like ice cream or bread or, you know, but actually, if you look at the recipe, they're actually not as complicated as you might think.
Yeah.
So every recipe in the book is easy or simple in one or more of these ways that I've just described. So if you want to make a meal and you're happy to spend a couple of hours, you look for all the M recipes that make ahead.
Right.
And you put them together and you go, oh, actually, I can cook the eggplants, roast them in the morning or the night before and dress them at that very last minute. I can make my fish stew that I'm going to make. I make all the sauce and then I put the fish in 10 minutes before it's ready to serve. And then I drizzle it with tahini and there's my chili fish with tahini on top.
Right.
So all those M recipes are very useful for that way of cooking. And in the same way, all the other ways.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to have that little acronym. And most of them have all of them have at least one. Some of them have several. I think there's maybe one or two that have all six. Like how many? All six. You mentioned P, which is pantry. And you also have a section in here called the Otolenghi pantry.
Yeah.
Your pantry is probably different than many people's pantries at home.
I can imagine. Yeah.
But I think you also have been credited for changing a lot of people's pantries and the way a lot of people cook. And particularly the ingredients they're seeking, not only in the UK, but across the globe. So, you know, you've really championed ingredients like pomegranate molasses, like barberries, like preserved lemons. Mm-hmm. And you're not the only author or the only chef to do that, but yeah. I think you get a lot of credit there. How have you sort of perceived those shifts across the globe and how people are cooking and how people are incorporating some of those ingredients that you think of as your pantry into their own kitchens? Yeah.
First of all, I always like to say to people that think of particular ingredients as feeling particularly exotic or remote or complicated to get your hands on, that it doesn't take a long time for an ingredient to travel from the periphery to the center. You know, only a few decades ago, mozzarella was in that position or olives or even olive oil. You know, they were exotic and expensive and something you'd had to get out of your way to come across.
Right.
So these are very shifty positionings, and I'm lucky enough to have helped certain ingredients migrate from to the center. You know, things like za'atar and sumac and preserved lemon and tahini and a few of those that you've mentioned are great ingredients, and they only needed someone to champion them in order to move into people's kitchens, you know, and they had them to start cooking with. So I see it as something that has always been happening, and I'm just championing one set of ingredients. But obviously, I'm very happy to see, and it becomes easier and easier to do that these days because the conversations around food, like we're having now on a podcast, are just happening on so many levels and in so many formats. And as a result, they move and shift very, very quickly. So, you know, if it took before, it took years and years for an ingredient to make an impact. Now I talk about it, the next chef in another restaurant talks about it, someone else, and then all of a sudden something that everybody knows. Everybody knows, you know, Korean chili paste now.
Right.
And it's only a couple of years that we've been talking about Korean chili paste, but all of a sudden it's something that we all have in our cabinet and are, you know, put into our rice or make kimchi or whatever it is that we're doing. So it's very exciting how quickly these things happen. I'm a small player in that world, but it feels very good to see all those ingredients appear on people's shelves. And the one thing I love is when I meet someone, they say, oh, I've introduced a recipe based on your ingredients to my cooking and it's really changed the way I cook or something like that. And I find that really gratifying.
We'll be right back with the second part of our conversation with Yotam Otolenghi. If you're a regular listener, you know that Salt and Spine is recorded at the Civic Kitchen, the recreational cooking school in San Francisco's Mission District. The Civic Kitchen offers hands-on classes and events for home cooks. We love the Civic Kitchen's open, airy, and welcoming space. It's a wonderful place for learning different techniques, cuisines, and styles from their roster of expert teachers. And personally, of course, I love the wonderfully curated cookbook wall, which is the backdrop of all Salt and Spine interviews. Now, don't miss upcoming classes like Thanksgiving 101 and Turkey the Japanese Way. You can find a list of all the Civic Kitchen's classes and sign up at civickitchensf.com. And now we have a featured excerpt from Simple Pleasures, a new podcast hosted by Yotam Ottolenghi, in which Yotam cooks from Ottolenghi Simple alongside guests in his home, while talking about topics like food, travel, and life's simple pleasures. Right now you'll hear Yotam and Nigella Lawson, who joined us on Salt and Spine earlier this year, as they prepare a delicious meal of slow-cooked chicken with a crisp corn crust, cucumber and lamb lettuce salad, and Nutella, sesame, and hazelnut rolls. Let's listen.
When I lived in Italy, I was very poor, and all I could afford was a kilo. I lived there with a school friend of mine, a kilo of tomatoes, and we had olive oil, occasionally a bottle of wine, and we used to sit, because I was a chambermaid, you know, in Florence, so I used to sit in this teeny little balcony outside the room with sliced tomatoes with mustard and looking at everyone going about the place.
So nice. I feel that I'm just starting to find out the notion of simplicity, of simple eating and living, and you've mastered it when you were, how old were you when you
19.
Were in Italy? 19. But you never went really complicated with your food ever.
But I never have because I don't have any training. So.
But you say that, but I don't think it's about training.
It
it's about aspiration.
No, it is, because I think it's about the fact that if you've worked, even for a short time, in a professional kitchen, you have to get an awful lot done, and you know you can do it. You may not enjoy it, but you can do it. Whereas it actually brings out a lot of lack of confidence in me if something is quite complicated and I worry I won't be able to do it. And that so takes over and makes everything daunting that automatically I don't believe I could do it if it was complicated. And I feel in a way, although I'm slightly ashamed to admit it, because if you do what I do, you're not meant to be frightened of anything. But it helps me when I write recipes, because I really understand it when people feel it's too much and they feel daunted before they start. So in a way, it means a lot to me to be able to convey how simple a particular recipe is. And I know that people can do those easily.
You've written somewhere that cooking something many times gives you the confidence to just walk into the kitchen, cook that, and there's no sense of, oh, will I get it right or will I get it wrong? It's just something that I do and I know. And I think this actually, a lot of professional chefs won't admit to it, but I think this is also true about professional chefs. This is why I never order the dish of the day in a restaurant, because I know that they've probably only tried it the first time today.
Yes.
And they haven't,
Yes.
And I know that even in my restaurants, I don't cook in my restaurants, but the chefs in my restaurants, I know that something that's on the menu now, it would be so much better next week when they've cooked it a few times and they've done it. So there is this idea that chefs know something, but I think home cooks work in a very similar way. It's that repetition that makes you perfect.
But in a way, the great freedom of repetition is that, and it's easier to do in a home than a restaurant, because people want consistency in a restaurant. So there are so many ways of cooking that we repeat over and over again, but it means you can't stop yourself in a way out of interest changing a vegetable in it or changing a herb or a spice. And so because of that, in a way, that's why I feel to people that actually, yes, do repeat recipes. When people ask me, you know, when I do an event of any sort, you know, about how I'm not confident in the kitchen, how do I get better? I always say, just choose a recipe and just cook it repeatedly. Yeah. So cook it enough times so that you actually don't need to look at the recipe, and that without meaning to, you can't help but change some of the ingredients as you go along. Right. And people like you and me sometimes, we want to inspire, and mostly we want to share our enthusiasms. But I'm also aware that by publishing so many recipes, you can sometimes lead people away from the fact that the easiest way to learn is actually through repetition and not, oh, I've done that one recipe, move on to the next.
Yes, I find that you really need to immerse yourself in a dish or a cuisine or get to understand a set of spices or a technique before you move on to the next thing, because it really induces anxiety. And I think a lot of the cooking has become very anxiety-ridden, because people who have just cooked one time meal go on to Burmese food, you know, the next day, and they go like, have you really enjoyed what you were doing, and have you really got something to put into your cooking?
And I also feel that you just, I think I wrote about this in How to Eat, but confidence is very important, but there's a less glamorous word, which is competence, and you do need to get competent before you can get confident, and that often means, I always say to people, cook for yourself. The idea that someone who doesn't ever cook suddenly says to 10 people, come for supper, It's terrifying.
Terrifying.
You know, so I think you do need to cook for yourself, because I often find that when I cook for myself, you know, I'm not worried about things going wrong, because it doesn't really matter. It's only my supper that's ruined. And therefore, I relax a bit. I enjoy the process more. I can see what's happening. And I think you taste and you see what you want to be doing. And then in a way, you need to have done that before you cook for other people. Because, look, I don't believe you should ever cook to impress people. But any human being
wants
to please. And so that you are frightened more of something going wrong.
And,
so you need to know it won't, or you need to know how this works.
Again, that was a clip from an episode of Yotam Ottolenghi's Simple Pleasures, as he cooks with Nigella Lawson. You can hear more episodes as Yotam cooks with guests like Great British Bake Off winner Nadia Hussein, Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda, and more. The podcast is produced by Pixiu for Penguin Random House and available wherever you listen to podcasts. And now back to our conversation with Yotam Ottolenghi. Has your concept of simple changed over time, and particularly in recent years? You're a father now, you're a parent now, you and your partner have two kids, right?
Yeah, we have two boys.
Yeah. In the United States in particular, when people think of simple or quick night meals, it's often parents needing to get things on the table. Has being a parent impacted how you sort of think, or what do you cook at home?
Yeah. It has definitely. Carl, my husband, and I, we have two boys, and we very much like think a little bit differently now about a meal. First of all, the meals are earlier, so you need to get them on the table, you know, to start preparing them at 5 and not at 7, you know, it makes a big difference. So that's one thing. But also, Carl does most of the cooking at home. I don't do that much cooking at home. Children just change your sensibilities altogether. And I find that when I come home, I really want to eat my children's food after having very complex food all day long.
Right.
So I think this book, although it champions, you know, Ottolenghi flavors, so all the recipes are still, you know, they have kind of that complexity that I like in my food, contrast of color, contrast of texture, is like a surprise flavor in each bite, etc. They're still maybe slightly pared down and maybe are a little bit more child friendly, even if it was only at the back of my mind when I was doing those adjustments. So there's definitely more kid friendly recipes in this book. Not too many, but there's quite a few. Like there's a kind of a fancy schnitzel that my kids love eating. There's fish fingers.
Yeah.
Made with fresh coconut, or you can use dried coconut that I really love making. So there's more dishes in this book that I'm happy to say that my kids will eat. Although with children, you never know, because if they don't feel like it, they just don't eat for no good reason. So,
right.
Yeah.
Let's talk briefly about your cookbook process when you're putting together a cookbook. One of the things I found most interesting as we were preparing for our conversation today is that you, I think historically, maybe still, do not use a food stylist.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah. I put all the food on the plate. For me, the way the food looks in my books is a kind of, it echoes the way I myself and my chefs present the food in our cafes and delis. There's always a big display of vegetables and a display of sweets and cakes and pastries. And this has always been my agenda, or not even my agenda. It's been my kind of my pet love, to be able to present food in a particular way. And I carry that on to the book. So when it's time to cook the recipes for the camera, I love to do it myself, to do the styling, if you want to call it styling, but I would just call it, you know, serving.
Right.
Because I try to minimize the styling. So nobody else needs to interpret me or think, how would I want it to look like? You know, because I know what I want my food to look like. And I really love it looking one particular way, and which is the way people have come to see my food through the book. Not very fancy presentation, but very luscious and delicious. And like I said, contrasted, and you really see a lot of details in my dishes. And I love that people can see details, because for me, that just makes you want to eat even more.
Right. Yeah. And I think I read that you also travel a fair amount. So how has that impacted the work that you've done on your cookbooks in particular?
Yeah. Before I had young children, I used to travel much more.
Sure.
Now I travel less, unfortunately. I hope to be traveling more again in the future. It impacts it a lot. And even if I don't travel physically, I travel through books or magazines or television shows, or vicariously through my team.
Okay.
To travel, right. You know, other people around me travel. So I constantly get inspired by things that are coming from all over the world. And it could be anything from a Mexican chili or from a spice blend from North Africa or from a way of steaming an ingredient like an eggplant in another culture. So I constantly get myself immersed in ways of cooking of different cultures. So traveling is one way to do it, but actually you can do quite a lot of it, you know, looking at books or,
right.
or cooking, you know, so you take a cue from something that you've heard about or listened to, and then you turn it into a dish. And
right.
I think we're really lucky to live in a world where it's very easy to be inspired by cuisines, even if you haven't been, like, I feel that I really know Persian cooking, although I've never been to Iran. And
sure.
I'm not lucky to even go there considering the political situation there, but I would have loved to, but just being exposed to, like I said, to books, to stories, to cooks that have come from there and cooks from me, it gives me a window.
Are there specific authors or cookbooks that have really influenced or inspired you over your career?
Yeah, I do have a big cookbook collection and
okay.
I love cookbooks. We were just talking before we went on air or we started recording about Nigella Lawson.
Right.
She's a friend of mine. I love her writing. I love her recipes and I love what she stands for, which is kind of humanizing cooking as opposed to some chefy attitudes where they're dehumanizing
right.
food in some ways.
Yeah,
it's an achievement rather than something that you'd need to enjoy cooking. So her book, How to Eat, has always been very influential. Now she's just celebrated 20 years
this year. Yeah.
Yeah. To its
very
publication.
Exciting.
But I always thought that her observations in the book were really ahead of her time. I love the way she treats food and talks about it. So that's really been very instrumental. I love books that are kind of like give you more than recipes and sometimes the theory. Like I love the Flavor Thesaurus.
Yeah.
By Nikki Segnet, which is some people think it's only for chefs, but I think it's for everyone because it's a thesaurus of flavors, as it says on the cover, but it really goes through ingredients and lists how to match them and how they reverberate in dishes. And she's got a really good way of telling a story and making you laugh and understand ingredients. I really, really enjoy her books. And she's got a new book that is just coming out in the UK called Lateral Cooking. And again, it's really in-depth investigation into how we cook plus great recipes. She's, I always love reading what she's got to say.
Do you remember the first cookbook you ever owned?
Oh, yeah. I remember it very well.
Okay.
It was by an Israeli author.
Okay.
So I grew up in Israel, obviously.
Right.
Called Ruth Sirkis. And it was a cookbook for children to cook. And it's really sweet. And I do remember cooking it from a child. It was sometimes comical, sometimes inspiring. Like there was an icon and it had like the archetypal mom's face. And when you reach a certain bit in the recipe that was a bit difficult, it had that icon and underneath it says call mom. Like when it was time to chop up something with a sharp
right.
knife or cook something on the heat, it says time to call mom.
Right.
It was very funny. And another thing that I remember really funny in that book was it had a, like we have in Britain and something called a sausage roll,
okay.
which I think is like a pigs in blankets.
Sure.
You know, so it's a pastry
yeah.
around a sausage.
Right.
But so we had, in that book, there was a kosher equivalent because obviously it had to be a kosher sausage
mm-hmm.
and dairy free pastry.
Uh-huh.
And it was called Moses in the blanket. In the basket. And I'll never forget that because I think it's such a funny name for something you want, like, why would you want to eat it if it's Moses in the basket? I mean, it's just hilarious.
Yeah.
But it was one of the recipes in the book.
Yeah. I love seeing how early food was there for you, that cookbook for children. And also your first word, right?
Was yeah, my ma. First word. Yeah, it was ma. Yeah, that's it. Was
which
meant like these kind of croutons that you put in the soup. Because
yeah.
my mom used to spread them on my, you know, in front of me. And I used to kind of munch on them. And
right.
yeah, I think she claims that was my first word. But I think all my early memories are food related.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything before the age of 7 that is not related to food. It's
yeah.
quite bizarre.
Wow. That's incredible. So I know you have to go, but I want to end with a quick little game that we like to play Please. With all of our guests. So we'll do a little rapid fire round. And now with your latest book, we know what Ottolenghi simple means. Yeah. So maybe I'll give you a fill in the blank option for Ottolenghi blank, and you can tell us what fits that mold.
Ottolenghi blank.
Well, I'll fill it in for you, and then you tell us what matches. Okay. So the first one we'll start with, what is Ottolenghi childhood dish?
It's definitely a dish from this book, from Simple. It's called gnocchi alla romana, which is semolina dumplings, Roman style. And my grandmother used to make it. It's literally the most ethereal, cheesy, delicious thing you can imagine. And it's very easy to make.
Amazing. Okay, Ottolenghi midnight snack.
That would be cheese. Yeah, like Parmesan, right? A really nice, good cheese.
Okay.
And I like cheese, but it's like a cheese and a glass of wine is what I have after a long day in the kitchen where I just don't want anything complex or too healthy or too righteous.
Yeah. that sounds perfect. That sounds like a great midnight snack. Okay. How about Ottolenghi pet peeve?
Oh, it's a tricky one. What really bothers me is claims about the health properties of food. For me, food is not a medication. You know, it's not something to put in your mouth to cure yourself. Food is a much more long range, long life commitment. And to eat well is about joy, and it's got nothing to do with health. Health is a separate thing. And I think if you eat things that you love eating and cooking, you're probably going to be healthy, but vice versa, it doesn't work for me.
Okay. I like that. Final one, Ottolenghi airport meal. I know you're traveling less today, but what do you
seek out? It's really easy for me, sushi.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it's something that I get either I take from, you know, from somewhere where near I live or buy it in the airport, but it's very easy to carry around. It's just to offer the right amount of, you know, balance with carbohydrates, with protein. And nice seasoning. That's what I take with me on the airplane. Okay. Always.
Perfect. That's great to know. All right. Well, thank you so much. This was so fun.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
We're headed now to Omnivore Books in San Francisco to chat with Celia Sack in this week's From the Vault. Hi, Celia. How are you?
Hey, Brian. I'm doing well.
Great. So we just sat down with Yotam Ottolenghi to talk about his latest book, Ottolenghi Simple.
Wonderful.
And I'm hoping you have some info to share with us today.
Well, I love Ottolenghi. He's such a mensch. Most, I have to say, most Israelis rub me the wrong way, and I just want to like punch them after 5 seconds because they're so confrontational. But he is just so warm and friendly and open. And, you know, he's just coming out with so many cookbooks now because he's got a whole lab basically that can test recipes.
Right.
And I teased him after his book Plenty More that his next one should be called Enough Already. but I'm really thrilled that he's done Simple because it is really simple. A lot of people are afraid of how many ingredients the other books have, which of course I don't think makes it difficult. It just means having a lot of ingredients, but you can oftentimes just throw them in. However, Simple is more like, you know, on the cover, there's this beautiful dish of tomatoes on this creamy cheese thing that's just fantastic and really, really easy to make. The meatballs, which I haven't made, but he actually made for me when I went to his house a couple of summers ago in London.
Okay.
And just so easy and delicious and lovable. So yeah. So I'm just so happy that he finally came out with something that is a little bit easier for people to tackle.
Sure. A little bit easier, but at the same time, his other books have a cult following, and particularly in the US have really taken off.
I used to tease him that I was going to rename my store the Ottolenghi Bookshop. because that's all I sold.
Okay.
Now all I sell is salt, fat, acid, heat.
Sure, of course. Is there a particular book you sell the most of his?
I would say Jerusalem.
Okay.
It's between Jerusalem and Plenty. Plenty is all vegetarian and Jerusalem has some meat, but you know, people are just so curious about this cuisine right now. Israeli food meaning so much more than just Israeli. It's that whole region. And he's really brought that to the fore and made, I think since his first book, we now have all of these spices that weren't available, like za'atar.
Sure.
Your corner store almost has to have it because he's pushed, or his work has pushed customers to demand it. So it's made cooking this food easier than it was when it first came out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much, Celia.
Of course, my pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. As always, you can find bonus content from this episode on our website, saltandspine.com. There, you'll find two featured recipes from Ottolenghi Simple: the plum, blackberry, and bay friand bake, and pappardelle with rose harissa. And you can enter our weekly giveaway to win your own copy of Ottolenghi Simple. Remember, if you like hearing from your favorite cookbook authors on Salt and Spine, and I hope you do, please click subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. And if you're inclined, please leave us a review. Our program today was produced by Allison Sullivan and myself. Our original theme song was created by Brunch for Lunch. Thanks, as always, to Jen Nurse, Chris Bonomo, and the Civic Kitchen Cooking School team, and to Celia Sack at Omnivore Books. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with more stories behind the cookbooks you love.